Hello, friend. I'm so glad you're here. My name is Zach Holt, and this has Come to the Table. Some of our most intimate conversations happen at the kitchen table. Walls crumble as space is created to know one another more deeply. Our hurt and our heartache are replaced by hope and healing when we pull up a chair, let down our guard, and simply be who we are, where we are. In our time together, we will step into the shoes of others through recovery stories of redemption, offer resources and connections for those in need, and come together as a community starving for revival in our region. So if you're hungry, you came to the right place. Well, we're so excited to have you here with us again on another episode of Come to the Table. It's always such a blessing to get to share new stories and hear just amazing transformations that we've experienced within our community. And friends, for those of you that are out there that are still struggling in the midst of addiction, still trying to lay it down, I just want to let you know that there is hope. And if there's any way in the world that we can come beside you, any way at all that we can help you, please reach out to us. I do want to ask again that if you have any questions or struggles that you're walking through, we will be doing another live episode on the first Tuesday in March. So we're still fielding email questions. So for those of you who would like to submit that way, you can email me, Zach, at thetablebristol117@gmail.com. And as I've said last week, it's a great place for us to have a forum, have an opportunity for people listening to hear questions. And the odds are that if it's something you're struggling with, it's something someone else is going through as well. So I do appreciate your vulnerability and your willingness to share those questions with us, because it's huge. You know, in recovery, it's not something that we do in isolation. In fact, I'm not sure that I know of any times that recovery has been successful in isolation. It always happens within the context of community. And so we want to be that for you here at Come to the Table. So today, we have a great interview with a dear friend of mine, Chris Nelson. We met, I guess, a little over 3 years ago now. And so Chris is going to share not just his recovery journey with us, but his current role in recovery work and kind of how he sees the value in not just strengthening his recovery, but in adding to the recovery of others and trying to pour into them and be for them what others have been to him. So pretty cool story. And Chris, we're excited to have you. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, why don't you just start off, tell us a little bit about yourself, where you come from, sort of what you've been through, and we'll let God take it from there.
I'm Chris. I'm 40 years old. I'm from Lee County, Virginia. I come to Bristol in 21, I think it was. And I come to Bristol Lifestyle Recovery, and that's where I met Zach at. And I didn't know much about God. I just knew about him. I didn't have a relationship with him and stuff. And I was strung out on meth and heroin and stuff like that. And I was looking for a way to get off of it. And I started applying myself to the things they wanted to teach you there at the rehab. And then I met up with Zach, and he became my sponsor. And then I got to know about God and formed a relationship with God. You know, there's a difference in knowing about God and having a relationship with God. So Zach helped me form the relationship with God. And that's what got me through, and that's what keeps me going today, is the relationship I have with God, you know.
That's good. So, and that brings up a really good question, because I think in this area, there's a it's a, you know, kind of a religious region, and so I think a lot of people would say that they know about God, they've heard of. How did that personal shift take place for you? How did God become real and personal to you?
Well, I guess I used to think God was like a genie. you know, you could you'd find yourself in a spot and you'd always ask for these certain things, and you just think, oh, yeah, come on, God, you can do this for me, and I won't do this again, or, you know, whatever. But it doesn't work that way, you know. You form a relationship with God, and you have to have that one-on-one connection. And then when you have that relationship with God, He's there with you all the time. He's not just a genie. And when you get that connection in your everyday life, he's there all the time. You just don't see him when you're in the bad times or in the good times. He's there with you every step of the way. You know, you have a God conscious, as Zach calls it.
That's good. That's good.
You know, you don't have to ask somebody if you're doing right or wrong. You'll have that conscious of what God, is it right or wrong? You'll know it's right or wrong, or if it's you're supposed to do it or not, you know. And that's something I use every day in my life. You know, I don't have to wonder, well, would God do this or not? Mm-hmm. If I do it and I feel it's not right, I know I'm in the wrong to do it, you know?
Yeah. No, that's really good. That's really helpful. Yeah, and as it becomes personal, you know,
yeah,
I think it begins to mean more to you. So one of the questions that I have about your journey that a lot of folks in recovery, we talk about a rock bottom. You know, we talk about a rock bottom as a place where the bottom falls out and you hit the rock, where you have nowhere else to turn and you run out of good ideas and there's kind of no way back. What was your rock bottom like, and maybe how has that sort of helped you in your recovery to get to that place?
I guess my rock bottom was being stuck at a McDonald's. Nobody to call in the middle of wintertime, you know, and nobody to reach out to, nowhere to go. And ended up back at like a trap house. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The only people that I could call to go stay at, you know, I'd done and cried cheap, you know, wolf every time mm-hmm. I could, mm-hmm. you know, I'm going to get straight this time. I'm going to get clean. Just help me to all my family and stuff that had helped me so many times that every time they would help me, I'd just go right back out after I got, you know, rested up or mm-hmm. got back on my feet a little bit. I'd go right back out until they got tired of helping me. And then finally they just cut all ties, you know, and I got stranded there, and I was there at the trap house for a little while, and finally wanted change for myself, and I guess God took the scales off my eyes and let me see what it was really about, and I finally got to see, like, hey, this is where you're going, you know, it's either death or jail or you can take a turn, and, you know, and that's really what opened my eyes, is like, there's only three ways to do it. You're going to jail, you're going to die, or you can turn your life around, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's really good.
That was my rock bottom.
Yeah, that's really good. Now, how would you, man, I got a couple questions. So one, let's stick with the rock bottom for a second. So how do you know, because now you work with the recovery center that you were once a resident at, which is just a really, really cool thing in and of itself, but you deal with a lot of people that are, you know, kind of walking through what you've been through. So how do you recognize if someone else has hit their rock bottom?
They apply themselves.
Yeah.
You can tell by the way somebody applies themselves or if they're coasting. Mm. If they're coasting, they're going downhill. But if they apply themselves, you can tell the ones that's getting they have like different groups. Mm-hmm. If they're getting more than one group a day or whatever, and they're doing everything they can, they got that notebook, they're mm-hmm. writing in it, they're trying to get the extra groups in, they're trying to get extra meetings in, going outside of the facility, trying to get all the groups and stuff they can in, taking in all the information they can, they're trying to make the next step mm-hmm. before it's time for the next step.
Yeah.
Those are the ones you see succeeding more. The ones that's kind of laid back, just do what they have to do to get by. Those tend to, you know, take longer to get it.
Yeah.
That's
right.
So the ones that's, you know, really applying themselves, mm-hmm. trying, doing above and beyond. I always say if they'll chase God or chase recovery a tenth of what they chase the dope man with, mm-hmm. they'll get it.
That's right. That's really good perspective.
No. Just a tenth of what they chased the dope man with. They got it.
That's a pretty low bar because it's not even 50% or 75%. No. Like, just give 10%.
Just,
you know?
10% of what you chased the dope guy with, and you got recovery.
And you'll do great.
You'll do great.
Yeah. And I love that when you talk about, you know, taking note. I took every meeting I went to for probably the first 18 months, I took a notebook with me and just writing down little bits of wisdom that I would hear.
You don't have to take big notes, just one word sometimes. And you might not think it's nothing then, but you'll think back on it later and you'll put it together and it'll mean something to you.
Yeah, no, that's right. You know, I think we talk a lot about being, you being fat, being faithful, available, and teachable. You know, that we look for those that are kind of faithfully showing up, you know.
Right.
Consistency is huge. And then available, you know, do they have space in their life for recovery? Because it does. It takes time and it takes investment. And then the big one is, are they teachable? You know, because you can't tell somebody something that they think they already know, right? It doesn't work too well.
If they come into it thinking, I know what I did wrong last time, you just sort of quit.
Yeah.
You just sort of give it up.
Yeah.
Because that's their first mistake, thinking they know where they went wrong the first time. Because they don't have a clue where they went wrong the first time. Everything's totally messed up, you know. Yeah. You don't have a clue of what you're doing, or you would have got it the first. You wouldn't be in this position where you was at.
That's right. That's right. You know? That's right. Yeah, there's an individual, I bet he's come through the program 6 times now, and it's every time I keep waiting to hear, you know, I have no idea what to do. I've made an absolute mess of this thing again. I need help. And I've yet to hear that from that individual. And I'm just like, you know, and it's crazy because it's like, man, looking at it from the outside, we think, man, how much lower do you need to go? Right. Like, how much more of your life needs to burn to the ground before you allow, you know, recovery to take hold, before you allow God to take hold of your life? And man, some people have a really high threshold for tolerating pain and discomfort.
It's funny you say that, because when I came to rehab, I was like, I'm going to go show people that rehab's not for everybody. It's not going to work for me. And, you know, I came and it, here I am 3 years later, you know. And if I can change and it can work for me, I don't want to hear excuse for anybody, you know. It can work for anybody.
That's right. So when you you shared a little bit about, you know, when you're walking through your story about how you, you know, you kind of would, so quote, like, clean up your act for just a little bit, just long enough to sort of regain some favor in a relationship, and then you would just go right back out and do it. I think an important question to ask is like, why? You know, like, why do I stay sober today, number one? But then for right now, like, Chris, why did you use in your addiction? Like, what do you think drove that?
I guess a lot of it, I didn't care enough about myself. Mm-hmm. And I looked, seeked for everybody else's approval. Mm-hmm. When really all in the approval I needed was God's. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have to get Zach's approval. Mm-hmm. I don't have to get somebody else's approval. As long as I'm living for me and God, mm-hmm. God most importantly, mm-hmm. it doesn't matter what nobody else thinks. Mm-hmm. You know, as long as I'm living for God in accordance to God, mm-hmm. and the best that I can, mm-hmm. Like, I'm not going to hit the bullseye, mm-hmm. but as long as I'm striving for the bullseye,
that's good.
That's all that matters.
That's exactly right.
You know, because nobody's perfect. Mm-hmm. He's the only one to hit the bullseye, mm-hmm. but he gives us something to go for.
Yeah.
And as long as we're striving for that, I know we're not going to hit it, because mm-hmm. we can't be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not possible for mm-hmm. us to be perfect, mm-hmm. but as long as we're going for that bullseye and we try the hardest, mm-hmm. that's all we can do. Yeah. And as long as we don't look for another person to give us that credit, mm-hmm. you know, or say well done or something, mm-hmm. and we're just looking for him to tell us that,
mm-hmm.
then I think that's what it's about.
I think that's really good and really wise. And, you know, I think we need to, you know, we need to know our why, because we need to know our need. And it's almost like those things that we don't acknowledge about ourselves, those things that we kind of dismiss and we write off, those things that we don't want to acknowledge about ourselves, are the very things that gain power and influence in our lives. And so it's like, when I step back and I recognize and I look and see, wow, man, some of the driving things for my addiction was, you know, I really wanted to feel like I fit in. I really wanted to feel like I belonged. I really wanted acceptance. And because I didn't find it elsewhere, I found it in narcotics and in the community of people who use narcotics, right? But if I don't know what drove me, if I don't know the why behind my addiction, you can't defeat what you don't define. And so I'm going to find myself always spinning my wheels and always trying to fight a battle that I can't ever win. And in the meantime, if I don't acknowledge this reality that, man, I feel like I'm not worth anything, then what happens is, as you push those feelings aside, it's almost like in a swimming pool when you're a little kid and you got a beach ball floating in the water, and you're putting all of your effort into submerging that beach ball underneath the water. Well, before you know it, that thing's just going to pop right back up. You know, it doesn't matter how much effort you put into keeping that beach ball under the water, it's going to come up. And in the same way, when we fail to acknowledge the deep things that drive us to make the decisions that we do, then it ends up splashing up in our face over and over and over again. And I think a lot of people can relate to not feeling like they have value and not feeling like they have worth. And so when people come to me and they ask, you know, man, what does this person need most? A lot of times the answer is not even to get clean. Like, a lot of times the answer is they need community. They need to feel like that they belong. They need to feel loved. They need to feel safe. They need to feel secure, you know. And so it's interesting when you start peeling back the layers, because you might ask the average everyday, why do you shoot heroin? And they're like, it feels really, really good. Yeah, but why? Like, what are you looking for? What do you think about all that?
Well, I've worked in it, you know, at the recovery center. And I went to did my CSAC A and, mm-hmm. and doing the schooling and stuff. Not only do
what's
I
a
have
CSAC A,
it's a substance abuse counselor assistant. And with all that, you know, I had the street side of it myself.
Sure.
So I wanted to learn the book side of some of it, you know. So with that, I learned a lot about myself. So a lot of us that's in addiction, it's more like a self-medicating kind of thing. We have a mental illness that it's easier to go out and get the meth or the heroin and medicate yourself to where you don't feel those things like you're not good enough or you self-medicate with it instead of going to the doctor and letting them find out what medications you need to be on or put you on this that don't work. And it depends on how a lot of people treat you because of those mental illnesses that you have. People treat you like an outcast or you don't belong or you're not one of them or you're different. You shouldn't be allowed in this group or that group or whatever when, you know, that's the way God made you. You're unique. You're special in your own way. And you bring stuff to the table that nobody else does, you know, in a special way. You know, it's not because you shouldn't be around. You know, everybody's special and he made you that way for a reason. You know, you just got to find what you need and what you bring to the table. Find your gift, you know. And a lot of times you have to, they have to get clean and get their brain back down to right. And then get those mental health things fixed out. And then, you know, it helps them a lot. It helped me a lot, you know, because I had a lot of the mental health stuff going on that I self-medicated for, you know. It made me feel normal, made me feel like I was the life of the party, like I fit in, you know, and like people wanted to be around me because I was the life of the party when I was under the influence, you know. And when I wasn't, I didn't want to talk to nobody. I'd go in a room full of people and I'd be in the corner. But under the influence, I'd go in a room and I'd be the life of the party, you know, swinging off the fan or something. You know, it didn't matter. But, yeah, a lot of that's self-medicating from, like, mental illness and stuff like that. So there's a lot that goes with, you know, addiction and stuff like that that a lot of people don't understand. It's not because they want to do it. It's just something that makes them feel like they need it to feel okay. Kind of speak.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. And I think it kind of confirms that. I think it's something we've talked about before that, you know, the alcohol and the narcotics, that's not the actual problem. It's a symptom, right? That there's actually something underneath that's driving that. So if you think about a tree with its fruit, if a tree has bad fruit and all you're doing all day long is just plucking bad fruit off, well, you're really not fixing the problem. You're just treating the symptom, right? That's you're just right. saying, man, this is a diseased apple. I'm going to keep pulling. Well, man, all these apples are diseased. Well, at some point, I'm going to stop thinking it's a fruit problem and I'm going to start thinking it's a root problem.
You think about it like this. If you got a needle stuck under the skin and you keep putting a Band-Aid on it and it heals over, but you keep bending that arm and that needle pokes back through the skin, that holds there again until you get that needle out.
Yeah.
So it's going to keep coming back again unless, you know, with addiction, you cure the addiction, but if you don't take care of the mental health, it just comes back again, you know.
That's it. That's absolutely right. And that's why I think we see, especially in our work with the unhoused population, it's just this big tangled mess of, you know, it's not just that they're unhoused, it's that they're unhoused and they struggle with dual diagnosis where they've got mental health issues and they've got substance abuse disorder, you know, and they've got trauma and there's all of this stuff to it, you know. And so I think from the outsiders, you know, who look in, they may think, well, man, he just needs to get a job. He just needs to pull himself up by his bootstraps and he just needs to get a job. Well, you know, and I've even seen situations where, you know, housing services have placed someone into an apartment, but it's still the same person that, you know, it's still the same person with all the trauma, all the brokenness, substance use disorder, with, you know, everything else that goes with it. And now you just have them. Now you just have them in four walls, you know, but it's like you haven't really fixed the problem. And so then what happens is the problems manifest again, you know, and it's like the nasty, it all comes out again. And it's like, no, at some point you have to stop and you have to do the deep work. And I think that's where, you know, clinical services available through agencies like Highlands Community Services or clinical services offered through Bristol Lifestyle Recovery, I think those can be tremendously helpful. And then also, you know, one-on-one, you know, kind of sponsorship kind of setting. So what was your experience like that? Was we kind of, you know, move through the 12 steps? What are kind of some of the things that you learned about yourself in the process that you didn't know before or tools that you learned?
A lot of things I learned about myself was like I had defects that about myself that I didn't know I had, like reasons I did stuff that I didn't know I did. Mm-hmm. And so I learned, you know, my actions made people treat me certain ways. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't their fault that I did stuff. Like, mm-hmm. I wanted to blame, you know, they did this, so I'm going to go get high.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't because they did that. It's my actions made them do something. Mm-hmm. You know, they just was protecting themselves. Mm-hmm. And so it was my actions, mm-hmm. and me not taking responsibility for what I did to start with, mm-hmm. is the reason I was getting high. It wasn't what they was doing. Mm-hmm. It was me, myself. I was just putting my actions and responsibility on somebody else. Yeah. Versus taking, you know, all the responsibility for myself. You know, they didn't hold a gun to my head or nothing, mm-hmm. like that. It was all me. I did it myself. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to blame somebody else, yeah. for me and being in the position I was in.
Yeah.
You know, when it comes down to it, it was all my fault, you know. But it's easier to blame somebody else, make them be the bad guy, than to come down and say, well, you know, Chris, mm-hmm. if you hadn't have done all this, mm-hmm. but when it comes down to it, I'm going to have to answer that they ain't, mm-hmm. you know, when it comes down to it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, through working the steps and stuff like that, that made me come to realization, you know, I'm going to have to answer for this, mm-hmm. not them. And it gave me a way to work through that kind of stuff and learn my mental illness and how to have a one-on-one relationship with God and how that works. And, you know, that really helped me a lot, that I didn't have to seek nobody else's approval, mm-hmm. you know, that, and if I needed anything, all I had to do was talk to God about it. You know, mm-hmm. He had all the answers. He had the key to every door and all the answers I needed. You know, mm-hmm. I didn't need nobody else's answers.
That's good.
And nobody else couldn't open a door up for me. Mm-hmm. If he opens it, he's the only one that can shut it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's really, really good. Yeah. And I think in kind of bouncing back a little bit to our, you know, how do you know if someone's at the rock bottom? Well, I think someone at the rock bottom is ready to look in the mirror, you know, because I think a lot of folks just, they're not at that space, you know, where they're willing to take a hard look in the mirror.
My rock bottom, I looked in the mirror and didn't know who I was. Yeah. Like, I look in the mirror, I'm like, who have I become? Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't know who I was. Mm-hmm. And it took a long time before I could ever look in a mirror and say, mm-hmm. you know, hey, Chris, what's up, you know? Mm-hmm. Just look in the mirror and say, what have you become, you know?
Yeah.
Because I didn't know the person I become. I wasn't nothing like I was before. It can change a person.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and there's a saying that we use a lot in recovery, and that's the idea of keeping your side of the street clean, you know, and how, you know, another way of thinking about the acronym for Alcoholics Anonymous AA is the only two things we're in control of are our attitudes and our actions. And so I can't control your attitude. I can't control your actions. I can't control everything that's happening around me. What I can control is my attitude and my action in response to those things that are happening around me. And that is in a sense really liberating, because there's a big difference between, you know, a person with an addictive personality and someone who is not. And my sweet mother, God love her soul, she has a glass of wine, and she does very rarely, but when she has a glass of wine, she stops there, because any more than that, and she's like, I don't like to feel out of control, right? But the way an addict's brain works is, you give me a couple of shots of liquor and a Xanax and a line of cocaine, and now all of a sudden I feel in control. You know what I'm trying to say? Mm-hmm. And so it's almost like, okay, now I've got my world on lock. And so it's this illusion of control, mm-hmm. and we don't want to let go of that. And we say, you know, that really until a person's pain becomes greater than their fear of living without the narcotic, they're never going to make that jump. Right? Because the fear is that, well, if I give this up, you're giving away control. You're giving away your main instrument of control in your life when you get sober. And it's subjecting yourself to this possibility that something bigger, something beyond, whatever kind of language you want to use to identify God, that whenever you are surrendering that main tool that you use for living and you're putting yourself in God's hands, like, that's a big jump. right? And somebody has to be really, really broken to take that step, because naturally we are survivors, you know? So we're going to, addicts like cockroaches, man, we'll survive anywhere and anything. You know, you give me a trap house with no heat in the middle of February, and I'm going to find out a way to rub some sticks together so I don't have to spend money getting the lights cut back on, you know? And it's like, so to surrender all of that in the hopes that this bigger thing, this God thing, man, maybe he's got better for me, and I'm just going to, it's like that trust fall, you know, where you just let yourself go and you find that the arms of the Father are all around you.
Just he placed me in a place, you know, when I was stranded there, that the place I was at, we had a stove that it had caught fire like a week before I went to stay there, and the back of it was melted off. Like, you couldn't even tell what it was doing, but we still used it to cook on. We'd take pliers and turn it on to cook a little bit, you know, and the cabinets had burnt and everything. But, you know, I stayed there for like a week or two. And like the guy that let me stay there, it was his grandma's house. Mm-hmm. And he'd been gone like 3 or 4 days. This is why I'm staying there. And his grandma come in. It's like, where's my grandson? I was like, well, he's been gone a day or two. She didn't even know who I was. I didn't know who she was. She's like, well, who are you? And I told her, I was like, he's been letting me stay here. And she goes, like, you got to go somewhere. I was like, can I borrow your phone? I don't have a phone or nothing. And I tried to call people and couldn't get a hold of nobody. And I was like, can you just give me a ride like an hour up a road? She's like, what do you mean? I was like, well, I'm from like another state. So I need a ride up the road. And she's like, where are you going? I was like, I don't know. I can't get a hold of nobody. You just take me back to my hometown and drop me off and I'll figure it out. Mm-hmm. And it was the middle of wintertime. Mm-hmm. It was Christmas that year. Mm-hmm. And it was a big old snow on. And she's like, well, you can stay a couple more days. Come to find out, he had been down the next town down in that state, and OD'd and was in the emergency room.
Oh, gosh.
This is where he was at. And he came back 2 or 3 days later, and, you know, I stayed there like another week. And one of the family members was going back to where I was from to an auction and gave me a ride back finally. But I think God placed me there to see, you know, the life that I was in for if I stayed on the path I was, you know. And everybody that come in is like, you don't belong here. You don't belong here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was like, well, I'm here, you know. And it's just the life I lived. And, you know, God placed me in those things to let me see what it was, where I was going and stuff like that, if I didn't change, you know. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have no other way. Every knee will bow. Mm-hmm. Every strong person will bow to him, you know. And I was so strong, like, I could do it by myself. I didn't need no help. But he put me in that position to where, you know, I surrendered to him. You know, I did it in that basement. I said, you know, if you'll just help me get back to where I'm from and get, I'll go to rehab. Mm-hmm. And I ended up at rehab, you know, and here I am now.
Yeah. Is it still hard for you to ask for help?
Some things. Yeah. Some things I will, you know. Because I feel like certain things you should have to try to, you and God should just have to work through yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, you shouldn't depend on certain things. I think materialistic things, it is hard for me to ask for, because I think me and God should have to work those out. From where I come from, I threw it all away. Mm-hmm. You know, I was set up, and I become the addict that lost everything, you know, so I think it's between me and God for me to work my way back from where I was to what I need, you know. Like prayer, it's not hard for me to ask or something like that. But
so as we kind of move towards the end of our time here today, one of the questions I ask every single week is, if you could have a direct line to somebody who's still struggling in addiction and you had 60 seconds to talk to them, what would you say?
What would I say to them?
Yeah, what would you say to the person that's still out there listening, that's struggling in their addiction and they don't know where to turn? What would you say to them?
Don't give up and turn to God. Yeah. Give it to God and He'll show you the way. Yeah. You know, just follow His trail. Yeah. You know, don't listen to nobody else. Yeah. Just look to Him.
Shut up and listen.
Shut up and listen. Know that He is God.
That's good.
Tune everybody else out. Give it to God, and He'll lead you the way, and just follow Him.
Yeah. Breadcrumbs.
Yeah.
Breadcrumbs. And He'll send people along the way to support you.
Yeah, He will.
On that journey.
And it might not be who you wanted it to be or who you thought it would be, but you'll know when it happens who it's from.
That's right.
You know?
Yeah. That's good. That's good. Well, Chris, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, man. It was a lot of fun. And friends, I want to thank you all for joining us on this episode of Come to the Table. We hope that it has been an encouragement to your recovery and maybe even created in you a curiosity about what it means to live into this new mindset of selfless service to others. If you'd like to know more about our ministry or for coaching on how you can more faithfully walk with others in their time of need, I would love to connect with you and pour into you. If you're interested in recovery resources or creating spaces for spiritual growth, you can reach out to us at thetablebristol117@gmail.com. Friends, you don't have to walk this road alone. Hope and redemption, beauty from ashes, light from dark, these things are all so much closer than you know. Grace and peace to you, my friend.